The Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is about 1:35 on the afternoon of April 23rd, Monday, 2007. We have a quorum here to do business today. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Huggins, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. The Judiciary Committee is ready to hear SB 150, and after that, SB 128, and then other bills previously heard, if we have time after those two bills. But SB 150 is up. Ms. Donnie Flegel is here to present the bill. If you put yourself on the record, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Senator French. For the record, my name is Donnie Flegel. I am a legislative intern for Senator Davis, who is the sponsor of Senate Bill 150 relating to crimes at domestic violence shelters. On July 25, 2005, Representative Andrea Dull witnessed an event at the Juneau Aware Facility. Hence, Senate Bill 150 and House Bill 213, responses to that experience. Domestic violence is a serious, significant, preventable public health challenge for Alaska. Alaska has the distinction of being in the top five states for per capita domestic violence rates, and Alaska's women are being killed by their partners at the rate of 1.5 times the national average. In 2005, Alaska shelters provided services to 8,793 clients. This bill will not solve this social ill. However, it will bring attention to protecting victims of domestic violence and will serve to draw the general public's attention to the need for social change and the responsibility we all have as citizens to protect the most vulnerable of populations. Over time, this learned behavior will change when it is generally known that such behavior can result in additional time spent incarcerated. Anchorage has seen that over time, rape is committed without the use of a weapon. Because it's known that should a weapon be used, the stakes go up considerably. This legislation will give courts the ability to impose additional time above and beyond the presumptive sentence for felonies committed on the premises of a shelter or a facility providing services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. Passage of Senate Bill 150 provides a tool that can be used to send a message that crimes committed on the premises of a shelter or a facility providing services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault are deserving of the maximum allowable punishment, and that the safety that is expected in such an environment will be enforced and respected. The language in this bill was left purposely broad, allowing the courts of each jurisdiction to determine the definition of facilities and services. If such a word as residential were to be inserted, it would eliminate STAR, a rape crisis center. It is not tied to particular facilities or services. Victims receive services in other places and are entitled to protection. In rural Alaska, there are recognized safe homes which do not receive funds from the Council on Domestic Violence. In this instance, again, the courts determine the definitions. Thank you.
Ms. Flegel, thank you. Questions from members of the committee for Ms. Flegel? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Donnie. When you look across the country, different states that have these provisions, could you give us any sort of background of the history and the results of that?
You know, there are some states that have some language. In doing my research, Minnesota has a statute that just makes it a gross misdemeanor, for instance. But it doesn't add aggravating factors, additional presumptive sentences, doesn't add additional time to that. And I did do some research and called the Department of Justice and took a look at the UCR and NCVS, which is the National Crime Victimization Survey. They do not break crimes, felonies that are committed at shelters or facilities out. Neither does the state of Alaska, so it's very difficult to tell you what the statistics are.
I have a question. I was thinking about the you at the end of your testimony answered some questions in my mind about facility providing services to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault. That is broad, and I was thinking it might be a hospital. It might be a first aid clinic. It might be something else. And you might be, you know, stuck with a definition that's a little broader than what you had in mind in the first place. I think we all know what a shelter means right off the bat. But the other half might be a little broad. And then I thought, well, now, wait a minute. This is an aggravator. So if we take that approach, the aggravator is going to have to be proved to a grand jury and then proved mm-hmm. to a jury after that in order for it to apply. And I thought that it's unlikely that you'd see an overbroad application of facility providing services to victims of domestic violence because of that, because the prosecutor would be unlikely to want to burden him or herself with a tough definition, with a tough burden of proof, unless it was a clear-cut case. Mm-hmm. And so while I have a little bit of a qualm about the breadth of that language, I can also see that it's probably only ever going to be used when a crime happens on the grounds of a known shelter. But there might be some extraordinary circumstances when you'd want the broader definition on the books. So that's my musing aloud. And if you have a response, I'd be happy to hear it.
Well, I guess the only response I would have is, in rural Alaska, there are federal funds that are provided for safe homes. And in those small communities, those homes are known as places of refuge. And it would be up to the jurisdiction in that district to determine if that is, quote, a recognized shelter or facility. Sometimes tribal councils provide domestic violence educational classes and those types of things. And then again, it's up to the courts to determine that.
Other questions from Ms. Flegel? We have a few people signed up to testify for SB 150. Let's go to that public testimony now. We have here in Juneau, Chris Ashenbrenner. Chris, if you'd like to come forward, put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your thoughts about this bill.
Thank you. I'm Chris Ashenbrenner, and I'm the interim program administrator for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And you do have a letter in your packet that I wrote on behalf of the council, and we fully support this legislation. We think it's very important to send the message that when an individual's seeking safety because of the violence they've experienced in their lives by going to a safe shelter or a program such as STAR or a safe home in rural Alaska, that we send a message that if somebody's trying to break into that place or commit a crime in that place, that we think it's important enough to do something extra to hold them accountable for that perpetration. The I was at the premises at AWARE when the perpetrator broke in, I think 2 years ago now. And the... And it's not unique. The perpetrators commit crimes on shelter premises and have over the years. And so it's not the only one that's been committed. I want to make that point. And I also want to make the point that this perpetrator did not actually gain access to the shelter portion. Most shelters are divided into two sections. One's administrative and reception, and the shelter is again, you have to get through another to a secured area. But there was no accountability for that extra step of going after his victim when she was already in safe shelter, and also of putting the people who are serving those victims at risk from his behavior, and the re-traumatizing the people who are already there because of their own traumatizing experiences. So there's a lot of layers to this, and I encourage passage and would thank you for doing so because it sends a good message that we are strong on this in Alaska.
Thank you, Ms. Ashenbrenner. Any questions? Thanks so much for being here today. Mm-hmm. We also have here in Juneau Sarah Lynn Tabachuik. Hi, Sarah Lynn. How are you?
Hi. I'm great. Thank you.
If you'd pronounce your name for me, then I'll know how to say it next time.
Sure. Sarah Lynn Tabachnik.
Tabachnik.
Tabachnik, yeah.
Excuse me for mispronouncing it. Please go ahead and give us your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Sarah Lynn Tabachnik, the Executive Director of AWARE here in Juneau, and I'm here to speak in support of this bill. there is a higher expectation and need of safety, specifically for the high-risk population that we're working with, women who have survived domestic violence or sexual assault. As you heard, AWARE did have a break-in into the administrative side of our facility. That was in the summer of 2005. At that time, our staff responded exceptionally well in calling 911, speaking with the police, getting them there as quickly as possible. And actually, we call her Charlie's Angel, one of our staff people who happened to be wearing heels and holding the door while the perpetrator was trying to get in the door. He did get in the door, and we subsequently, thankfully, have gotten a new door. That was a wood frame door, and now we have a metal frame door to increase our security. But it was, of course, a little traumatic for people who were in the administrative side of the building, primarily staff. So, you know, we're asking for passage of this bill to promote increased safety for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, as well as to hold batterers accountable for their behaviors. Thanks.
Ms. Tabachnik, thank you for being here. Any questions? Don't see any. Thanks so
thank
much.
You.
Thanks again. On on the off nets, we have one person signed to testify, and that's Linda Stanford at the Arctic Women in Crisis Shelter. Ms. Stanford, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. We'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Linda Stanford, and I'm the program coordinator for Arctic Women in Crisis, which is a domestic violence sexual assault shelter located here in Barrow. And I'm calling in this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 150. I am so excited to see this bill move forward. And, you know, we often talk about that we need to hold offenders accountable. And here's an opportunity to provide tools for our prosecutors and others to do that. You know, safety is one of our primary goals, and I think you've heard the other people speak to this. People will often ask me, Melinda, you know, what is your primary function over there? And I will always, always answer, it's safety. Safety is first and foremost our primary goal. And, you know, without it, how do you provide the crisis intervention? How do you help the children report sexual abuse? How do these things happen if they're not feeling safe? So it's, you know, in order for us to do our job and for us to assist these victims, we have to really look at safety issues. In 2006, AWIC provided almost 3,000 safe shelter nights. That does not include our safe homes out in our outlying villages. That would just be here at our facility in Barrow. And, of course, those safe nights did include nights for women and children. Ginger, who is the director at the shelter in Dillingham, one time someone asked her, how do you measure success? And, you know, without even hesitating, she said, it's when I see the children come in with their eyes full of fear and then a day or two later see them playing. And, you know, I have to totally agree with Ginger. And, you know, maybe that's a little hard to measure, but when we, that's been our experience, when we see children come in, they're so afraid. They're hiding behind mom, and it's really difficult when, for example, if someone comes into work on the facility, they'll run and hide, and there's just this instant look of fear. So it takes some time for these children to, and women. I definitely don't want to leave the impression we're just talking about children, but it takes time for the victims to become safe and to trust that where they're at is safe. Last July, we had a really dangerous perpetrator spotted around our building numerous times, and then we went out one day to take someone to the court, and we noticed that another client's windshield had been totally beaten in. It looked like someone had taken a hammer to it and just beat the windshield in. Reportedly, he was angry because another client had given his partner a ride. So, you know, as I testified last week, I asked the question, so imagine how angry he is at her, his partner, for, you know, being in this facility where he cannot get to her. And he's also very angry at the AWIC staff. And, in fact, he has confronted staff members. He has threatened staff members, and I'm not going to go into more detail, but we still have ongoing issues there. But I wish I could help you understand how that one incident caused additional trauma for the women and children staying here. All of a sudden, because they know this man's reputation, they know how dangerous he is. All of a sudden, you know, the women were afraid to go outside and smoke. People were, like, looking out all the windows all the time. Children were, you know, very anxious and hiding. And it really, and of course, it made an impact on the staff as well, because he had already made threats towards staff members, too. So it just really impacted our entire program. Before that, approximately 4 years ago, we had a perpetrator try to break into the building. As I said the last time, I was fairly new at that time, and so I'm holding the door while he's trying to come in, and was able to hold the door, and he did not gain access into the building. But that, again, was very frightening, and he came very close to getting into the building. And I know that our safe homes out in our villages, they, you know, whereas we have, you know, security cameras here, we have metal doors, we have, you know, different security measures, they don't have those luxuries. And I really encourage you to please take our safe homes into consideration when you pass or look at passing this bill. I think you have a letter, or you should have a letter from Nellie Sears, our safe home provider out in Point Hope, where she describes just one incident. There have been others. A safe home provider in Point Lay talked about for 2 days, all during the day and a night, during the night, a perpetrator ran around the house and was beating on the house. And just, you know, it was just very frightening again. And she, after that one particular incident, almost, you know, stopped working with us as a safe home volunteer because she, you know, was so afraid. So, you know, we're talking small villages where these are known safe refuges or safe havens. I mean, here in Awick, or here in Barrow, where we have, you know, over 4,000 people, if you get in a taxi and you give them our street address, they'll go, oh, Awick. You know, so even in a village as large as Barrow, which is relatively small, people know where Awick is. So you can imagine out in villages where you're talking a couple hundred people or maybe a little larger, these safe homes are known safe havens, and they really do need additional protection. Abusers and perpetrators, they know exactly what they can get away with, and they will push it to that limit almost every time. And so you really can help protect the victims by sending the message that these shelters are going to be safe havens, and that any act of violence or trespassing will be taken seriously. So again, I just encourage you to please pass Senate Bill 150.
Ms. Stanford, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Stanford? I don't see any. I'll just note for the record that there are letters of support from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. There is a letter from Ms. Ashenbrenner. There is a letter from Virginia Walsh, a clinician at Arctic Women in Crisis, and also the letter referred to by Ms. Stanford from Nellie Sears, who provides a safe home in Point Hope. Any other questions or discussion amongst the committee members? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I recall, we did something similar to this on school sites. It had to do with assault last year. We went through this examination of whether certain hours, school events, the district headquarters, and which brings to mind to me the, I don't know, let's just say a village, and teenager drinking, goes to this site, doesn't have any idea where they are, they break in, are they subjected to this?
If they break in, I think the answer is no. If they break in and commit an act of violence, I think the answer is, I beg your pardon, committed the offense on the premises. You're right.
My question is, it reminds me, I watched a short video this weekend on the young man that was a good football player down in Georgia that went out right before he graduated from high school, using drugs, alcohol, girls underage. He spent 20-some years, and everybody said, no, that was a bad thing, but that's what the rules laid out. He had to spend 20 years in jail. And I just would hate to have unintended consequences, because the broadness of the issue, if you broke into the wrong target, you were off by one address factor, but you broke into the place and you and the aggravator was applied to you. That's my concern.
It seems like a fair concern. Senator McGuire.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I don't know if Annie might be willing to help. I was going to pull up real quick. In aggravators, do we use mental intent language? Is there a precedent for that? Because a thought that I would have would be to amend it to make it clear that the defendant committed the offense on the premises with the intent of harming, with the intent of threatening, harming, something like this, the staff or victim. In other words, to avoid unintended consequences that Senator Huggins is talking about. We know who we're talking about. We're talking about the individual that wants an opportunity to get at their victim, and maybe they're going to threaten or assault the staff, or maybe they're going to get through to their victim. And so we know what it is. We know what we're talking about. We know it's a separate trial. But is there anything we could do to tighten that up?
Mr. Chairman, Senator McGuire, I don't think this is a concern for aggravating factors, because okay. These are discretionary factors that the court uses in sentencing a person. They have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury, and they don't. They only apply when it's appropriate, or a court doesn't apply them automatically because it happened in a certain place. Once we prove it, then it's up to the court to decide whether or not to aggravate a sentence. So I really think it, I mean, although I understand the concern, and in some cases mandatory sentencing can apply and create unintended consequences, for factors in aggravation and mitigation, it's really up to the court in the particular situation involved.
So under Senator Huggins' scenario, while it may technically apply that the defendant, this intoxicated defendant who broke into a shelter thinking it was someone else's house, while he may be technically guilty of burglary or criminal trespass, may even technically be in violation of the aggravator, the sentencing judge would be able to decide what weight to give the aggravator and proceed
correct.
Accordingly.
And our judges usually have lots of common sense.
Senator McGuire.
And I believe, through the chair, if I can recall this correctly, that knowingly, absent a mental intent, knowingly is the mental intent. So if we read it with statutory construction, it would be the defendant knowingly committed the offense.
I would say you would probably mean committed the offense knowing that it was a shelter.
Okay.
So that
even
would,
even higher, yeah.
To the extent that culpable mental states even apply to aggravating factors, which I've never heard them that described.
Okay.
I don't think it's a concern. Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Want a motion?
Motion, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move Senate Bill number 150 with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal notes out of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, we'll take a brief recess to get the paperwork in order. The Judiciary Committee will come back to order. Next up on the agenda today is SB 128 by Senator Donnie Olson. We have a representative from his office here to present the bill. Good afternoon. It's nice to see you. If you put yourself on the record, the committee would be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jenny Osterman, and I am staff to Senator Donnie Olson. In an effort to regulate the sale, distribution, purchase, and shipment of alcoholic beverages into damp local option communities within the state of Alaska, Senate Bill 128 requires the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board to create and maintain a database that will allow businesses that sell alcoholic beverages to keep track of written orders for alcohol shipped to each buyer. Anytime a written order for alcohol is received from a resident of a local option area, the package store licensee must consult the database prior to filling the order to ensure that the customer has not already ordered their monthly quota for that month. Alcohol may only be shipped to the personal residence of the person placing the order unless they reside in an area which has a community delivery site. In that case, all alcohol must be delivered to that site and not the personal address of the buyer. The alcoholic beverages ordered cannot be sold to another person in the community. Such conduct would be a Class A misdemeanor. Having information readily available in a database will prevent bootleggers from ordering alcohol from multiple package stores in violation of the local option. The information in the database will be accessible only to package stores and law enforcement. None of the information would be public information. Senate Bill 128 also contains a provision to correct an omission in state law relative to the transfer of liquor licenses between an organized borough and communities in that borough. Many communities across the state have used their allotment of liquor license while their borough has not. Boroughs may now transfer alcoholic beverage licenses to those communities. There are several people signed up to testify on this legislation, I believe. Annie Carpinetti from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law is here to answer any questions you may have. And Attorney General Kohlberg is also here.
Thank you, Ms. Osterman. I don't want to keep General Kohlberg waiting too long. Perhaps we could go to his testimony. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chairman French and committee members. I'm here today partly because I am Attorney General Designee, but also because of that position. I hold the position of co-chair of the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Commission, which is where this particular legislation had its genesis. Before I was ever in this position, the commission, which was formed by the United States Department of Justice, had basically been established through the sponsorship of Senator Ted Stevens to look into four issues plaguing rural Alaska, and one of the issues was alcohol interdiction, alcohol problems, and what to try to do about it. And so in the course of pursuing trying to address that particular issue, the commission had established work groups and interviewed something over like 200 people and obtained suggestions and ideas on how to try to address alcohol in particular. And this legislation is the final result of suggestions made from those work groups and in interviews, distilled down to what was thought to be practical and a reasonable approach to try to, not expecting to solve, but to reduce the problems associated with alcohol. When I first testified on this bill before a House committee, by coincidence, the day before, articles in the Anchorage and Juneau papers talking about the disproportionate level of the suicide in Alaska's rural communities, about five times the national average, and relating that to alcohol abuse, and then not unrelated to it, the preceding testimony you heard on the other bill in rural Alaska, there's a disproportionate amount of domestic violence. There's almost any type of social issue has problems associated with it magnified in rural Alaska, often because alcohol is involved. And so this legislation is designed to focus on trying to make the attempts to interdict alcohol in villages that have chosen under the laws we have to be dry or damp to make them more meaningful. And so one of the features involved in this is lengthening the time such determinations by a village will have effect instead of having a one-year turnover, extending that time period a little bit longer so that there's not just this instant reaction where there's a campaign to undo what's been done almost immediately. You give it a little more time to try to work. The most prominent feature of the legislation before you is the database that is basically trying to establish a centralized manner of controlling and monitoring what's happening by purchases to damp villages in particular. And then there's also the feature involving ingredients for homebrew alcohol coupled with the concept of intent, which you just got into. But in this case, intent would have to be demonstrated. You wouldn't just be in trouble for having the ingredients without any intent associated with it or the equipment associated with it. So the Rural Justice Commission had voted to support this and brought the legislation up through the Department of Law, and Senator Olson is one of the sponsors, as you've heard. And I'm here in my capacity as co-chair of that commission to again reiterate our support and the effort that went into bringing it to you as an effort to try to address in part one of the major problems of rural Alaska.
Thank you. Questions? Senator McGuire.
Yes, and thank you, General Colbert, for being here. My question is just on the last subject on possession. And we dealt with this a lot when we were dealing with the methamphetamine omnibus bill.
Possession of the ingredients?
In ingredients, my apologies, yes. So page 5, section 10. And it does say, with an intent to use the material or equipment to create an alcoholic beverage. And I just wanted to know, what we ultimately decided was that, and the committee was really split, frankly, but we decided that it was very difficult to prove that when you were in the possession of some of these ingredients and materials used to synthesize down the Sudafeds and so forth, that the person actually had the intent. And so we debated about it a lot, and I just wanted to hear a little bit more thought about why you felt it was important to put "with the intent" in there, and whether you felt you had a good shot at proving.
Well, I have two parts to the answer. The first part was, again, a lot of this was assembled before I was even on the commission, but we have discussed this at the staff level in the Department of Law even as early as this morning. And what we think the value of a discussion with Mr. Svobodny actually this morning of keeping that in there is, in a comprehensive view, there might be an occasion where you have a witness that says, "I was going to work on this particular project to make this happen," and it's just another tool. It really, I think, the question that is more problematic is enforcement itself in rural Alaska. And Representative Salmon actually asked the most direct question. He said, "What good does any of this do absent the enforcement capability in these locations?" And that is really what, to get to your question, is going to be needed, is someone's going to have to be in a position available to even look into this. But it's a tool that, if it's there and the circumstance arise, it gives you more options than you would if you didn't have that. Do you want to add that? She often has more.
Through the chair, you're correct. As we discussed with the possession of Sudafed with intent to create meth, it will be difficult to prove. But in those circumstances where we have the proof, probably including an admission of some sort, it will be good to have it available to us.
Just to follow up on that, I take it the possession of homebrew itself is illegal because that's an alcoholic beverage. So the bucket of homebrew is the most likely charge because you don't have to prove intent, you just prove knowing possession. Is that right?
Through the chair, that's correct. The possession of ingredients for homebrew only applies to dry communities.
Sure. And I mean, you guys know the debate as well as I do. It just strikes me as being just almost beyond comprehension that someone would be prosecuted for the possession of sugar without a bucket of homebrew in the near vicinity. If you've got the homebrew, you bust them for the homebrew. If you don't have the homebrew, I just can't imagine anyone ever pleading to this. I would force you to take me to a jury trial, and I can't imagine a jury ever convicting anybody of possessing sugar or yeast outside some kind of a, you know, I suppose you could get a signed confession. you know, that you were about to whip up a batch. On the other hand, as a prosecutor, I'm happy to, former prosecutor, happy to give you a tool if you think you need it. But I have my, I've expressed my skepticism about it. Along the same lines, Section 12 adds a new section by saying a person who purchases alcohol in violation of, and what statute is that, 0411-499B?
Whoa.
Pardon?
When you refer to
what this one is.
Oh, okay. You have that's included in this bill, and that's
so that's in the back.
It's on page five. It's added on the starting on line one of page five.
Line
one. That adds
the
penalty for violation of this substantive section.
Oh, okay.
So it's a person who resides in a municipality that has adopted a local option, may not purge alcohol, was sent, transported, or brought alcohol beverages into the municipality, violation of local option. So it's essentially buying alcohol in a dry community?
Or, Mr. Chairman, it's the bootlegger is guilty of importing.
Bootlegging, right.
Bootlegging, which is a Class C felony. The person who buys from the bootlegger under this provision would be guilty of a Class C felony.
And before this, it was not a crime to buy alcohol in a dry community?
It would be a crime to possess it. I would imagine this would apply much more in damp communities. If you buy alcohol from a bootlegger knowing it was brought in illegally, you can be convicted under this new section for buying bootleg alcohol knowing that it was bootlegged.
So let me, I must have, maybe there was a little bit of background noise. It's against the law to bootleg, to bring in alcohol, to import. That's
in violation of a local option, yes.
Okay, that's the C felony. Is it illegal simply to possess alcohol in a dry community?
In a dry community, yes, it is. But it may not be necessarily illegal under current law to possess it in a damp community. But if you purchase it from a bootlegger under this section, knowing that it was bootlegged and it's not brought in legally,
so this,
it would be a Class A misdemeanor under this provision. And normally, the penalty that you refer to, normally in Title IV, we don't put penalties because all the violations are Class A misdemeanors. But the reason we made a special section for a penalty here is that it's part of the same statute that prohibits bootlegging, which is a Class C felony, and we wanted to clarify that the purchase of the bootleg liquor was an A misdemeanor as opposed to bootlegging itself, which is a Class C felony.
So just, I'd hate to seem dense, I just want to make sure I understand that this Section 12 is about a person who buys alcohol in a damp community from someone that the person knows is a bootlegger. So there's no question that, because you can legally import to a damp community for your own personal use, but you can never buy from a bootlegger. Okay. Follow-up questions on that topic. Thank you. Other questions for representatives from the Department of Law? I don't see any. We've got a couple other people to testify, so thank you very much, General Kohlberg and Ms. Carpinetti, for being here today. Also on the line, we have Loretta Bullard. Let's go to Ms. Bullard. She's in Nome. Ms. Bullard, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
If you go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, we'd be eager to hear your testimony.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Loretta Bullard, and I'm president of COLERIC. I also serve as a member on the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission, representing a BPSO contractor in the state. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 128. Alcohol and substance abuse is the nucleus around which many of rural Alaska's social problems revolve. Alcohol is a contributing factor in many, if not the majority, of suicides, homicides, child sexual abuse and physical neglect, domestic violence situation, and accidental death and injuries from rural Alaska. It's a 100% factor in children diagnosed to be FAE and FAS. I estimate that 90% of the Alaska Natives serving time in Alaska correctional facilities are serving time for offenses conducted under the influence of alcohol, for consuming alcohol while on probation, or for importing or brewing alcohol in violation of the local option law. Alcohol abuse has a huge impact on Alaska families and on the state fiscal situation. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 128. Many of the provisions contained in Senate Bill 128 are practical solutions that were developed as part of the Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission process, which Attorney General Kohlberg spoke to. And I won't summarize those provisions since you have that already. I did want to say that the recommendations in Senate Bill 128 primarily address the supply side of the issue. I encourage the elect legislature to also make additional resources available to help address the demand for and treatment of alcohol and substance abuse. Alaska families, communities, and the state budget would benefit if the state proactively explored and set in place means to prevent and minimize the impact alcohol and substance abuse has on Alaska's communities and families before problems occur, as opposed to locking up individuals after the fact. While the provisions contained in Senate Bill 128 reflect only a small portion of the options that were developed, if implemented, they are a step in the right direction. Attached to my testimony, which your committee clerk has a copy of, is a list of the options that were developed by the alcohol work group for consideration of the commission. I want to note that there are many more options that have not been fully explored and recommended by the commission simply because we ran out of funding to continue our work. I know that the Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission has submitted a request to the state legislature, I think it was in February, asking for stopgap funding to continue the work of the commission, and I encourage the legislature to do so. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Bullard. I don't see any questions for you. Thanks again for appearing in front of the committee this afternoon.
Thank you.
We also have on the off-nets Casey Reynolds from the city of Wasilla.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can. Mr. Reynolds, go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'll be happy to hear your testimony.
Okay, my name is Casey Reynolds. I'm the economic development planner for the city of Wasilla. I'm here to testify about the portion of Senate Bill 128 dealing with the relocation of liquor licenses within boroughs into incorporated cities. Our city, like many other cities in Alaska, is growing pretty quickly, and as a result of that, we're seeing a lot of investment come into the community. The problem is, because of the way the liquor laws are structured, we only have 4 beverage dispensary licenses to be used in the community, and those are obviously being used by very profitable businesses. So we're having trouble attracting restaurants, both local entrepreneurs and national chain restaurants, into the community. We have on our planning about 1.2 million square feet in retail to be developed in the next 2 years. That includes the Target development as well as some other major retail developments which should be announced in the next week or two. And there are several restaurants that want to be a part of that, again, both local restaurateurs as well as national chains. But what all of them have been consistent about saying, both the developers, the restaurateurs, local business people have all made it very clear that the one thing that's really standing in the way of that is the inability of those restaurateurs to get beverage dispensary licenses, full beverage dispensary licenses for their restaurants. Here in Wasilla, since there's only 4 available, those tend to go for about $500,000, which is pretty cost prohibitive, even for national chain restaurants. So when we try to attract these kind of investments in the community, it becomes very difficult. The restaurants, they need city services of water, sewer, police, fire, whatnot, and so they really need to be located inside the cities. So they won't locate in the area, really, unless they can be inside the city. So that they won't go outside the city limits where they don't have those kind of services, and they can't really locate inside of the city limits because they can't get a beverage dispensary license, which means a large portion of their business model is immediately kind of off the table. So what we've done is we've crafted this solution which would allow us to use licenses allocated to the borough inside of cities as long as both the borough and the city affected agree to it. And what that does is it really allows us to maximize the efficiency of liquor licenses, because these kind of communities like Wasilla, Palmer, and some other communities around the state, we really serve as hub for populations that live mostly surrounding our area. And so since people come here for their retail shopping and their grocery shopping and their government services and everything else, it really makes sense that they would come here for their dining experiences as well. So it makes most sense that most of your liquor licenses should be located inside of, of these cities. And so what this does is it gives us, as public policymakers, a tool to use to help make that happen if we feel it's appropriate. If a city or a borough feels that this kind of use isn't appropriate, they can simply not approve it and it would not happen. And since this, what this does is it doesn't create more liquor licenses, it allows us to use existing liquor licenses more effectively. We were able to get unanimous support from the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, from the Public Department Public Safety, and from several other communities around the state. And so we really think it's good public policy. Really haven't heard any objections from anybody on it. We just think it's good public policy all the way around.
Mr. Reynolds, thank you. Maybe you could just give me an example of where that might play out in the Mat-Su borough, just so I can sort of make it concrete in my mind. Where might you relocate a license into or within a incorporated city?
Well, you might. We've seen all over the borough, businesses go under, either bars or packaged liquor stores or restaurants. Some, I think there was recently one out in Big Lake that went under. And so when those restaurant, when those users go out of business, they would then be able to sell that license to someone inside either Palmer, Wasilla, or Houston for its use there, so long as both the city and the borough approved of that relocation.
And those are the only three incorporated cities that would fall into that category in your borough?
In our borough, yeah. And sure, you wouldn't be able to do it between boroughs, so you wouldn't see one going from Fairbanks North Star to Mat-Su borough. It would only be for borough licenses to be used within those boroughs inside the incorporated cities.
Further questions on that topic? I don't see any. Mr. Reynolds, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
Next up is Doug Griffin from the ABC board. Mr. Griffin, can you hear me?
Again, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and put yourself on the record, and we'll be happy to hear your testimony.
My name is Doug Griffin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. I'm here primarily to address questions regarding the fiscal note and perhaps how this database might operate, since it would be lodged within the ABC board. But before I do that, let me just back up. And I am speaking on that topic basically for myself, since the board has not taken a position. But the board has taken a position on the topic that the previous speaker talked to, and he is correct that the ABC board did hear a presentation from Mr. Reynolds and does support the concept of allowing the more free movement of licenses within boroughs to serve the need. But basically, I'm here to answer questions about the fiscal note that we prepared. And let me just kick it off by saying it primarily reflects the cost of creating and maintaining the database that's being envisioned for keeping better track of written orders that of alcohol to rural Alaska. There is a component in the bill, section 15, I believe it is, of the bill, which calls for the creation of a delivery site pilot project. Investigation of potential costs there is still ongoing and is not reflected in the fiscal note. Part of that I can justify, I suppose, because the pilot project would only be authorized at the request of the local governing body. In this case, the bill requires the city council for the city of Bethel and the city council for the city of Kotzebue to request that that a community delivery site be created. And since you can't necessarily assume that invitation would be extended, the cost of setting that up is not reflected in the fiscal note. But we are, I am working with supply personnel here within the Department of Public Safety. We are doing some preliminary investigations about what some of the costs would be if, in fact, this bill passes and we were invited to set up a community delivery site in either Bethel or Kotzebue or both. We do expect that would be a very expensive proposition. So I put that on the record, and you are talking about having access to a fairly large building, having very top-flight security on that building, since it will be containing alcohol and would be a real target for someone to try to break into and burglarize. So we do have some experience with community delivery sites in other locations in the state. So that is something. So I just want to go on the record that the fiscal note does not reflect the delivery site component in Section 15 of the bill. But other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or members of your committee have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Griffin? Maybe you could just, Mr. Griffin, maybe you could just walk me through how you see the database working. Just, you know, sort of take the average alcohol sale as an example, and who would enter the data, where it would be reported to, and to whom it would be made available after that.
Okay, I'll do my best, Mr. Chairman. And I should mention too that this is a change. This is a substantial change from the first hearing in this committee, in that we had the Department of Public Safety at that point put in an indeterminate fiscal note because we had not yet tried to crunch the numbers to decide what the cost of doing the fiscal note would be. So we did make a correction on that by adding this additional information. I should also preface this by saying I was a member of the alcohol working group of the Alaska Rural Justice and Law Enforcement Commission. So I was in sort of the group that was just trying to come up with ideas about ways to try to address the problems of crime and justice and the enforcement and the adjudication of criminal activity in rural Alaska. And, of course, alcohol and the abuse of alcohol is first and foremost a component of that problem in our state. So certainly we did focus, the alcohol working group was a important component, I think, of the commission to try to make recommendations. Well, the idea basically is there in much of rural Alaska, we do have communities that have voted by local option to go completely dry. And I kind of laugh when I talk to my colleagues in other states. Of course, their definition of dry is really our definition of damp, in that their sales are not allowed in counties throughout parts of the United States in the lower 48. But in Alaska, of course, when we say dry, we mean a ban on importation and possession of alcohol. You know, probably about 80 or 90 communities in the state have made that decision. However, that certainly does not reflect the reality that alcohol does not continue to be a problem in those communities. And of course, we are talking about illegal sales by bootleggers who, because there is the demand for the product, as the woman from Nome testified earlier, it fetches quite a bit of money, $150, $200 for a bottle of liquor. So one of the ways that alcohol does make its way out into rural Alaska is through something that is legally permissible. This is the way that people that reside in damp communities, and of course Bethel and Kotzebue, Unalakleet, a handful of other ones are probably the hub or sub-regional hubs, where they have voted not to allow not to allow a liquor license, but they do allow people to order alcohol, receive it, and legally possess it and consume it. And so it is through these regional centers, Bethel, Kotzebue, are two of the big ones, where people can go through a process that's pretty cumbersome, intended to be so, where they pre-purchase alcoholic beverages to be shipped to them. They are limited under state law and how much they can receive in a certain month. That limitation is 10.5 liters of spirits, 24.
Mr. Griffin, hang on 1 second. I thought I asked you about the database, which.
Okay, well, I'm getting to that. I thought it would be good to explain the process that the database is trying and the. What was seen by the commission is sort of the holes in the process we were trying to plug. But I'll get to that within 30 seconds, I promise you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, but hold on. Let me ask Senator McGuire for questions on the points that you were just covering.
Oh, wait.
Okay, she's going to hold her question. Go ahead and bring us into the database in 30 seconds.
Okay, well, people can legally order 10.5 liters of spirits, 24 liters of wine, and 12 gallons of malt beverage beer. That's how much they can get in a given month. The concern of the alcohol working group is that someone could order that amount from, say, Brown Jug. They could then place that same, and certainly someone who's a bootlegger and wants to sell alcohol could then also place a similar order with, say, Gold Rush. Then they would place a similar order of that limit to another package store. And so that there was no means of cross-checking or having a clearinghouse for this information. And that's where the database comes from. I think I made my 30 seconds. But hopefully, and so that seems like a simple idea. And when we entered into this, we said, okay, so there should be a way that people that do place these written orders, which there's a fair amount of record keeping that package stores that engage in this business have to do. And not every package store is engaged in written order. They have to notify us if they want to be in that. They're all eligible to do written orders, but they all have to talk to us and tell us because there's information we provide to them if they want to be in that business. So the idea of the concept of the database is simply to be able to do this cross-check, which seems like a very simple idea. But as with many things in life, simple ideas, when you start digging into them, have a level of complexity that you don't imagine when you just think, oh, well, let's just have a means to cross-check orders for people at written orders so they can't game the system and actually, you know, use the law to obtain all this alcohol for resale as a bootlegger. So,
Mr. Griffin, let me ask you.
That was the idea of the database, right?
Sure,
there, pure and
sure.
Simple.
And who is in charge of entering the data into the database?
Well, the law talks about that it is the individual clerks, and this is where the level of complexity gets involved. And I'm not a computer phenom. We had some of our best minds in the computer field in the Department of Public Safety working on this. We are talking about that the people that obviously are involved with the written order program would have to have a means to access the database. The idea as set out in law would be that the clerk, upon filling a purchase, would enter that data, and that would show for that individual that when they reach their limit, that when another clerk at another establishment tried to place that order, a flag would go up to show that the quota had been met for that month. So this is where the cost, the raised eyebrows about the cost of this, it would be web-based. There would have to be quite a bit of security, not only because there's proprietary information about sales from a private company that they would not necessarily want their competitors to have access to, and also just privacy issues with regard to people not wanting information about how much they order for alcohol being easily available. So there would have to be fairly high levels of security involved. It would be something that would, however, be accessible for law enforcement purposes. And so that's why the fiscal note reflects a fair number of hours of a consultant. There's no real database off the shelf that really reflects this type of program that would have to be available for multiple users if more people wanted to get into the business of doing written orders and has this ability to keep track of the amount of alcohol being shipped by written order to location to damp communities in rural Alaska.
And it sounds like from your description that there is no state oversight of the database. The database is merely a way for one clerk to know whether another clerk has already sold an individual a certain quantity of alcohol within a given time period. And what's the time period? I think you said per month, is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's a monthly limit. We do put in our fiscal, it does reflect actually an additional a criminal justice technician position to provide oversight, to troubleshoot, to answer questions, to do some auditing and monitoring of the system. And so we are looking at there being somebody that can help not only the vendors that are participating in this, because as with any kind of a computer system, the whole thing could go down, and then what do we do then? And so we would have to have pretty tight procedures on how to go about monitoring and providing access to this, training for people to do it as we train new clerks that come on board. So there would be some some oversight and some support, some necessary support. So we do call for a creation of a new position to do this, and that's part of the ongoing cost. We had the big first year of creation of the database. We have a fairly, we have a significant part contractual component of the second year to do fine tuning. We know there'll be bugs that need to be worked out, issues that need to be addressed. So that's why the first 2 years of the fiscal note, there's that. But then after that, it becomes basically a maintenance budget for maintaining personnel and a little bit of maintaining the database.
And how do you intend to monitor whether package stores are actually entering the data that the that they're receiving in the form of orders?
Mr. Chairman, that's where we would need to be doing an audit to make sure that, that all of the written orders they received comport with and balance with what gets entered into the database.
So someone would compare the written orders, the paper orders, with what's in the database?
Yes, sir.
But that's not the technician. That's a person that's somebody else.
It would probably be this technician going around to the package stores doing that, that type of oversight. It's more of an accounting function. This is a, this person is going to have to be very multi-talented. It was not easy for me to decide what type of what classification of personnel would be needed. They have, they're going to be, this is, will be a very unique position. There, that is more of an accounting function. We would probably be looking for somebody for this position that perhaps has some of those skills, but it's somebody who would have to just be able to understand the law, understand procedures, be able to do some at least comparison like that. It's not like heavy duty accounting, but would have to do some oversight.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Griffin? Senator McGuire has a question.
A couple comments and questions. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Doug's
Senator
my
McGuire.
Constituent. So a couple thoughts for you to think about in terms of modeling. I went to law school in Oregon, and believe it or not, their entire alcohol sales are regulated by the state and sold only through state-owned package stores. And you may already know that. But the reason that I bring it up is because when we're looking at community distribution sites, this may be a place for you to go in terms of information gathering, the state of Oregon and how they put it together. And in point of fact, an interesting thing has happened there, that there is a profit margin that is derived that goes to offset the costs that we know that are very real of alcohol in communities. And so you might look at that as a model in terms of the community distribution sites. And then the other thought that I had was on the registry. I know there are some states, and we discussed this in judiciary last year, that maintain methamphetamine registries. And the same problem came up with respect to regulating over-the-counter cold medicines like Sudafed and so forth. We wanted to know, you know, if you're buying 10 or 5 at Safeway and then you go down to the store to the Fred Meyer and so forth. So we came up with the compromise, but there was stronger language that came from other states that did have a registry that went ahead and reflected those orders. So that may be something to look to as well in terms of modeling a registry. And then finally, I wanted to know what you envisioned, and this might be a question for law. I don't see penalties for improper and unauthorized use of information contained in the database, and I think that might be a provision we would want to include given the sensitivities that you brought up. It's very clear that the only people that are to access it or who it's available to are, you know, listed 1 through 4 there in section 1, but I think what we might want to be clear about is that we don't, just because it's available to a package store licensee or agent or an employee, we would not envision that they would be using that information or releasing it in an unauthorized manner. And people's privacy is something we respect a lot in this state. And then finally, the last thing is, do you envision, or has it been discussed, and maybe Department of Law could also answer this, what type of a penalty would be assessed to the agent who fails or employee to input that information in a timely manner? And is it set up like the sale to the minors? Is it a warning system? Is it a three strikes you're out? Is what is the penalty if an employee or an agent fails to enter that information?
Senator McGuire, through the chair, first of all, I appreciate your suggestions. They're very good ones regarding the other states and the models that might be available for methamphetamine registry. Those are really good suggestions, probably ones we should have thought of, but I really wasn't aware of some of that methamphetamine registry. So that's good information. I will certainly take that in and probably use it. Probably someone from the Department of Law would be better in terms of penalties for disclosure of private information. I don't really have much in response to that.
Mr. Griffin, then thanks. We're going to hold you right there, and we'll have Ms. Carpinetti, who's in the hot seat with a statute book.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, penalties for violations in Title IV are all Class A misdemeanors unless specifically made some other offense.
Wow. Okay.
So does that complete the thought? I mean, would failure to maintain the integrity of the database be automatically criminal? I mean, it's referred to, but nothing says that it's a violation to release the information.
I believe so. I think it might be a good idea to specify, as we did in terms of buying bootleg liquor in a dry community,
right.
It might be. Although the law does provide that all violations of the title and the regulations are Class A misdemeanors unless specifically provided that it's something else. So that when you say the law currently limits a clerk in a package store from sending alcohol in response to written orders to a certain amount, and then this bill would add to that before sending that alcohol, they have to check the database to make sure that the purchaser hadn't already reached his or her limit for a month that is legal to be sent to damp communities. So I would assume that somebody who sent without consulting the database, that would be a violation, but I don't know whether you would want to make it a Class A misdemeanor or not.
Yeah, I think I need to stop and think here because, I mean, you can see there's several steps in the process. There's consulting the data. There's entering the data,
yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
There's entering it, entering it incompletely or mm-hmm. falsifying it. There's consulting the database and doing an inadequate consultation. And then there's, you know, protecting the integrity of the database.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Those are at least three areas where I can see you can kind of go wrong. And several of them seem like, you know, I mean, problems, but I don't know if it's criminal. I need to stop and think if it's going to be a criminal act to fail to check a database for a private citizen that we're imposing a fairly high duty on liquor store clerks. They're you know, nice people, but they're not state troopers.
Well, they are selling a, you know,
sure, they're selling a controlled substance, right?
To
right.
people, so they
right.
they do need to be cautious, but maybe an A misdemeanor is not
right.
Although I would say that a person who knowingly distributes information that is confidential on the law
yes.
should be held
yeah,
to a pretty high standard just because that's, you know, as Senator McGuire says, it's
sure. And maybe you can remind me what's the penalty for selling alcohol to someone who's for not checking someone's ID and selling into a 20-year-old?
Class A misdemeanor.
Class
yeah.
A misdemeanor. Not checking the database, not checking the license.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that applies to bartenders in
sure.
in pubs.
Sure.
Yeah.
So would this become part of the training that the folks who sell alcohol go through?
I would imagine.
One would imagine that.
Yeah.
Further
like
questions,
an ID.
Senator McGuire.
So just in wrap up, Mr. Chairman, is it your intent to hold this over for a little work?
I'd like to hold it over just to
feel more
give the bill a
great.
Good go through and just think about where exactly we put the. Wait on a clerk.
So just through the chair, if Ms. Carpinetti has any preferences about how we do that, my thought would be I would feel more comfortable, even though I know that is the read into, if you will, level of penalty. When we in section 12 on page 6, we specifically state a person who purchases alcohol in violation of AS 0411-499B is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. I kind of like that, and I think I would like to see personally, and I know that the chair has just said he might, I think it should be a high penalty, and I think we should state for unauthorized release of confidential information contained in the database, and that penalty should be specified at least there. And I think it might be helpful to go ahead and really emphasize that the person who has that duty to enter it in will have some penalty, and I think we could talk about what that should be. But I don't, if you, to the extent that you have input on that between now and Wednesday or whenever we bring it up again.
I'd be happy to supply some amendments for your consideration.
Great.
Wonderful. Is there anybody else here in the room who wants to testify on SB 128? Anybody else online to testify for SB 128? Mr. Griffin, I hope I didn't, we had a good conversation with you. Were there closing thoughts you had on the bill that you wanted to share with the committee?
No, Mr. Chairman, I know you're busy. I think I'll be happy to work with Ms. Carpinetti if she needs any of my expertise in her work, and we'll work on this and try to address the issues that have been raised. I think the committee's doing a fine job of reviewing this pretty complicated piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. And with no further action on this bill, let's hold it over to the next committee and take a short recess. We're back on the record under the category of bills previously heard. This bill was notified for last Friday, but we had to cancel the meeting due to a lack of a quorum. But this is CS for Senate Bill number 78, Judiciary, sponsored by myself. We now have a CS in front of us, and that is /Charlie. If we could have a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt CS for Senate Bill number 78, /Charlie, for purposes of discussion.
And the principal change that was made here was to make clear that the just like driving with illegal tinting, to install illegal tinting is an infraction. It's a traffic ticket. It's a maximum $300 fine, and that puts everyone on the same footing, treats everybody the same, and should clear up some of the heartburn, if you will, over the high penalties initially envisioned by the bill. Other further discussion or comments on the CS? Hearing and seeing none, to the extent that there was an objection, is there any further objection to adopting the CS? Don't hear or see any. Further committee discussion on the bill.
Ready for a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we move CS for Senate Bill number 78 out of committee onto the next committee, with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, CS for Senate Bill 78 is moved out of this committee. Short recess. With no further matters to come before the committee, we are adjourned.